Welcome to Clarity Funds Podcast. I'm Dr. Owen Anderson, and I'm here today with Greg Malloy for episode 5. Hi, Greg.
Hello, Owen. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
We are going to talk today in episode 5 about how we got into philosophy and especially into apologetics. What is it to do apologetics? And I've talked in a previous podcast somewhat about how I did that. I might go into it in some more depth today, share some more, but I'm interested in hearing from you. How did you become interested in philosophy? And I know you've especially been teaching at the college level, been teaching apologetics. So how did you get into that?
Yeah, for me, there's a lot of things from my past that I have trouble connecting the dots how I got places, but this is not one of them. There's a clear path. I remember how I went step by step from becoming a Christian into apologetics. So here was how the path went for me. I became a Christian, and I was very zealous to talk to others about Christ and their need for Christ. And so I went out sharing my faith with people, right? Saying, hey, you know, come and believe in Jesus. And some people had questions for me. Well, what about this? How do I know God exists? Or why should I trust the Bible? Or why be a Christian? And so I had these conversations, and I realized that there was a lot of questions people had that were ones that I hadn't necessarily worked through fully, or maybe particular questions that I had just not really had really tight answers to. So that got me into the realm of apologetics, right? So giving answers, a defense for the faith. And the more I got into apologetics, I realized how historically apologetics was connected up with philosophy. So that got me then into the history of philosophy, arguments for God's existence, philosophy of religion, and then it branched into other areas like philosophy of language and all kinds of world religions. So for me, it went definitely from a zeal for evangelism into apologetics, wanting to give a defense for my faith, and then apologetics led into philosophy as a kind of broader discipline that undergirded it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That's somewhat similar for me, where I had an interest in talking about Christian doctrines and encountered other religions and didn't really have a way of showing that what I think is true. I mean, I realized quickly that the reason I think my beliefs are true and the reason they think their beliefs are true are similar, which is we sort of were raised that way. Mm-hmm. And so I thought they were wrong, but they thought I was wrong. And that got me interested in, well, how would you know which one is right? And I'm one, in one way, that kind of reveals the difference between philosophy and apologetics, though, because apologetics is defending a position. It's really kind of a legal term. We see it in the Apology of Plato, Socrates defending himself. So the other persons I met in other religions all had their own ways of defending themselves also. And that made me start to think about what are the different apologetical methods that are out there. How did you work through those?
That came about after I got involved in apologetics. I started researching all the different arguments that people would give. That's when I came across, oh, hey, there's actually different schools of philosophy on how we're supposed to do this. And I think my initial take, I guess I would say, would probably be something of a classical apologetics approach.
Yeah.
I leaned more towards that, so I was influenced heavily by Norman Geisler. I mean, I think I've read just about every book he's written. That's a lot. And William Lane Craig and others. And I read some of their critiques of evidentialism. So kind of my introduction into evidentialism and maybe presuppositionalism was kind of almost like a polemical thing, kind of an introduction by those who were critiquing it. But I tried to give them a fair shake. I tried to investigate them. So I read Habermas and McDowell, Van Til and others, and various books that were comparing the different views. And I think, and I actually didn't stay, I think broadly I was a classical apologist, but I certainly had presuppositional leanings. Like for a long time, if you asked me how people know that God exists, I would say, well, just deep down, they just know.
Mm-hmm.
And I might have even cited Romans 1, chapter 1 for that.
Yeah. Yeah. People often use Romans chapter 1 to say, although they knew God, and that somehow this knowledge continues. They continue to know God, even though very quickly then says they exchange that knowledge for idolatry.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I've heard other people say something similar to what I experienced, which is that it's kind of a challenge to if I knew. And I wonder in my case if it was sort of initially wanting to prove myself right. And that could be in any hobby. Like say you really like, you know, collecting railroad memorabilia, and someone says, that's a dumb hobby. And you might feel pressed to say, no, it's not. It's really neat. Let me explain why it's neat.
Yeah.
And so I wondered about that with apologetics. And I think I felt that myself where someone said, you don't know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to say, yes, I do. Maybe you don't know what you're talking about, right?
Right.
And so that got me initially into the kind of arguments.
Interesting.
But then from there, I started thinking about the philosophical issues about not so much just defending the Christian position, but how do we know, especially how do we find meaning? Because all this was occurring in young adulthood, which is a kind of formative time when you're thinking about meaning of life, purpose of life. And so how do we find meaning in our life? And that's a little bit different than apologetics.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that kind of ties into some other branches of philosophy and apologetics. Maybe we'll call philosophical theology. So wrestling through questions that are even within the Christian community, how do we understand the Trinity, the Incarnation, things like that? Those questions can come up in a Christian context.
Yeah.
And so you might have to give a defense for those, even in terms of other Christians might say, well, I believe this, but I'm not really sure I can make sense of it. And so that got me into philosophical theology for certainly a time. I still am, but there was definitely a season where I was focused more on questions of that than I was
so articulating
philosophy of religion.
Major doctrines.
Yeah. The atonement, creation. So much I found it. So much of Christian apologetics is just really explaining clearly basic ideas. So what Christianity is. So a lot of times when I deal with could be Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses or Muslims. And half the time I just have to clarify, okay, no, this is what the doctrine of the Trinity is. This is what I hold to.
Yeah.
And that can go a long way.
Yeah. I'm wondering about, for me, it was a question, it quickly became a question of God's existence because I noticed that the groups I was working with, you named some of them just now, interacting with, they also affirm God exists. And so I went and saw William Lane Craig debate an atheist. And the arguments that he gave were for a kind of maybe general theism, right? And he did very well against the atheist in this case. I think he usually does, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in my case, for me, I was thinking to myself, how do I know this applies to Christianity? Like, how do I know this is Christian theism as opposed to some other form of theism? Did you go through that as well?
That's a good question. I can't say existentially I really went through that too much. I wouldn't say that I doubted seriously. Not in terms of maybe say Islam. I wouldn't say I had significant questions about that. Maybe working through questions of Judaism and Christianity, I think that was a significant question because it was, is Jesus the Messiah? How do we know he's the Messiah? Jews don't think he's the Messiah. Jews don't think he's the Messiah. And so I had to work through a number of those questions. But again, those were more philosophical, theological things, not so much philosophy of religion or apologetics per se. At least I didn't think about them that way in my mind.
Yeah.
So I was thinking that led to more biblical studies. And so you can almost see a trajectory too into biblical studies and theology, because I realized that in engaging in apologetics, I did go into philosophy, but I should say there was a kind of a separate road too. I had two tracks kind of going at the same time, because I was actually bivocational. Most of my life I've been both in the academic field and in pastoral roles. Mm-hmm. So I was a full-time pastor for 7 years, but I've also been teaching for about 10 years, and often they've been intertwined. And actually, interestingly, I was in a secular, academy, Arizona State University, for my undergraduate. And I left there to get an undergraduate at a Christian college because I thought I wanted to go into pastoral ministry. So I said, well, I better get a Bible degree or something. So I did that. And then I went from there into seminary. And then I realized during that time that, I think I really want to be more in the academy. So I left seminary to go back to a secular school to get my master's degree.
Yeah. And you've been teaching in the secular and religious
schools. Both. Both. Which has been nice. That's, I think, is a good mix for me.
Yeah. Well, and when you're doing pastoral work, what do you find, to what extent do people, Christians, when do they get interested in apologetics? Were they very interested, and what got them interested?
That's a good question. I know that when I was doing pastoral ministry, I think that was a big struggle that I often wrestled through, is how to get people more interested in this stuff. I mean, some of it's just circumstantial. Sometimes it's just young persons and they get interested in, how they're early 20s and they just kind of get fired up about something. But I found, I guess if I had to give it one answer on the whole, I would say it's when challenges come.
That's what I was asking. I didn't, without wanting to impose that.
Yeah.
I was kind of curious to see if that was what it would be.
Yeah, I think so.
What I might call existential crisis. And what I mean by that is some trial that comes up in life that raises questions about how you've understood life, the meaning of life.
Yeah.
And that makes us scramble to say, oh, maybe I didn't know what I should. I wonder if that's a common phenomenon, which is, and it's a common phenomenon for Christians and non-Christians, which is we think we know.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, it is Christians, and they think they know the truth of Christianity. But then something happens that kind of rocks their life.
Yeah. It could be as simple as engaging with someone who doesn't hold their view. So you're a Muslim neighbor moves in next door, and they're real nice. And you're like, oh, those are nice people. You know, and you get talking to them, and you're like, oh, they're so nice, but they really believe different things. And how do I talk to them about this? And then they ask you questions like, oh, yeah, I don't know. Jesus is God, but he died. God can't die. How's that work? And you're like, oh, interesting. I never thought about that.
Yeah, right. So you get some challenges like that, some questions. But the similarity is that you thought you knew it, and it shows you don't know it.
Right, yeah.
And I wonder if that's happening that gets people into apologetics. Because, and again, that could happen the reverse, right? You might have a neighbor from another religion, you ask them questions, and they get into their religion's apologetics,
right?
And they start delving into their historical arguments that their theologians have given and come back at you. And then that's why I'm thinking I'm kind of bracketing philosophy off as a separate from that, which is getting not simply how to defend our current religion, but actually asking certain basic questions that all religions ask. And we're asking, how can we know the answer to these questions? Which is really what we're trying to do at Clarity Fund. We're bringing up some of these questions like, how do I know anything? And what is real? What is eternal? And what is good? And those are a little different. That's like, I'd say, more basic than apologetics.
Yeah. I've never thought about this before in terms of categorizing it differently, but there could be maybe different types of apologetics, maybe like I don't want to say an unreflective, or maybe just a kind of almost like a fideistic apologetics where you already assume your view's true.
Yeah.
And I'm just looking for reasons to defend it. Like, I think about sports arguments. Like some people out there still don't think Tom Brady's the greatest quarterback ever. I mean, it's just silly, right?
Yeah.
But I still hear people, they are committed to their particular quarterback, and they just search the internet for data. They try to mine for data to help that. And so you can say that they're engaged in a kind of apologetics.
Yeah, that's how sports work, right? That's why they call it a fan, which means fanatic.
Right, exactly.
Right? So you're committed to your team for some rational reasons and some non-rational reasons.
You were raised with it.
Yeah.
Your dad was a cheesehead, and now you are, and it goes on and on. And so you think Aaron Rodgers is the best, and you just look for any information you can. And then I think in that sense, a lot of people who engage in our projects, I think, are doing that.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what you're saying is this is different from philosophy. We're not just looking to defend our particular view. Philosophy is addressing basic questions that all people need to answer. And then I think you could say that then once you've established those things, and let's say it shows that God's existence is clear and the doctrines of Christianity are true, then from that point, you could still say you're still engaging in apologetics, you're trying to defend that to others, but it seems quite different than what others are doing.
Yeah, I wonder if we could use the model of Socrates in the Apology to illustrate it. So once we encounter him, or by the time we encounter him in the Apology, he's on trial. And he's giving a defense of his actions. So he's already committed to those actions and defending them, giving an apology for them. But the thing he's defending is his philosophical pursuits.
Hmm.
And those are two separate things. So he was doing this philosophical pursuit, especially trying to find out if others know or they only think they know, which we're saying is one of the very most basic things to do is find out what is knowledge. And then in the story we're reading, he's defending that pursuit.
Yeah.
So I wonder if those two different things, and in what we're doing here, we're certainly doing both, but I think we're especially trying to draw people's attention to those basic questions.
Yeah, I like that. I like that distinction. That's good. So he would be doing, having these discussions, addressing these issues, regardless of whether he was on trial or not. That's not what motivating him to start thinking about this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, oh no, I'm going on trial. I better work through these things.
Yeah.
He's just doing it as a human being.
Yeah.
Yeah,
trying to figure out what is the meaning of life, or what is good, or what is justice. So asking these questions that underlie much else of what we do or think. And then thinking about how Christianity has certain answers. You might be called on the spot and put on trial, so to speak. Not an official trial, but questioned.
Yeah.
Why do you think these things? And then you give a defense in that context.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a test. It's a test to see how much you've been thinking about this stuff. And that's why a lot of people maybe resist this kind of challenge, is they feel put on the spot.
Yeah.
And it gets exposed that they don't really, haven't really thought about it. They don't know. And so, you know, as a teacher, when you give your students a pop quiz,
yeah,
I say, what, pop quiz?
Yeah.
No way. You didn't tell us that.
Yeah.
Hey, that's the pop part, right?
That's the whole purpose.
Yeah. And,
pop quiz hotshot.
Yeah. And then they, it kind of, you know, the sweat, and they don't, you know, they're unprepared. It's a very, you know, it's a very, disturbing feeling to be put in that situation, especially when you're on the spot, especially about things that are this important.
Yeah.
It's one thing if I ask you right now to, you know, give a defense for why free market economics is the best, you know, just something maybe it's not in your ballpark.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, I don't know. I can't give a great defense of that at the moment, but man, I don't know if that this is as basic as these other questions.
Yeah.
Right. And if people haven't thought about this stuff, there's a natural implication there, or question I should say, that comes from that is, well, why haven't you thought about that?
Yeah.
What have you been thinking about? Well, I've been busy thinking about other stuff. What other stuff?
Yeah. What's more important than this?
Yeah.
So it calls into a question, in one way, it's sort of your integrity as a rational human being. And I think people usually are able at, we'll call it level one, to give an answer. So if you were to ask them, what's the meaning of life? They give you an answer. But it's when you then ask the follow-up, how do you know that?
Yeah.
Level two, where they'll start to resist. And I think what I'm wondering about, this comes through in a couple different stages of the discussion, thinking about how I got into apologetics and what I've observed with people defending knowledge claims, and then asking you about the pastorate and how do Christians get interested in it. I wonder if there's especially this sense of pride where we think we know and we don't know, and we don't like not knowing to be exposed.
Yeah. I think so.
And that really is what we saw Socrates going through as well. The anger wasn't just that he's doing philosophy. The anger was that he'd exposed persons in leadership roles, especially that, as claiming to know but not knowing.
Yeah. Did you ever do that with your professors when you were in school?
Well, yeah. I can remember times where I did it correctly and did it incorrectly,
yeah.
Which what I mean is immaturely.
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, I've experienced both that too. I remember particularly in a history and philosophy of science class one time, asking a professor about certain presuppositions and interpretation of data, certain data he was taking one way, and asked him about how it could have been interpreted another way.
Yeah.
And he got a little testy about
yeah.
it. Because it was, he was being exposed before the class that he hadn't, you know, obviously not thought about this other interpretation. I think in this instance, I was doing it appropriately, but I was giving this as an example of people resist strongly
yeah.
when they're exposed like
yeah,
that.
Especially if you're an authority.
Yeah.
But when you're a teacher, you should all the more be ready to show you know.
Yeah.
Because you're teaching, you're claiming to know. And that's why there's a connection between knowing and showing, which kind of brings us to our third segment, what I want to ask you about. You'd already mentioned Romans 1 and connecting that up to what we do at Clarity Fund. When someone claims to know something, if they're an expert in some field, I think it's perfectly natural to ask them to show it. But there's some resistance sometimes to that in philosophy, to say somehow knowing and showing aren't connected. But if someone says they're the best quarterback ever, they're going to be asked to show that, right? You don't get away
right.
with just making that claim. Or someone says, I'm a world-class accountant.
Right.
Well, you'd be expected to show. I mean, if you're under perpetual audit with the IRS and always going mm-hmm. bankrupt, you're probably not the best accountant ever. So
right.
we expect there to be some kind of ability to show that you know. And so bringing that back to this, God's existence. And what Romans chapter 1 says is that the eternal power and divine nature of God are clearly seen. Why is it important for us to show that?
Yeah, that's good. You know, I mentioned a while ago about Romans 1 and my view
yeah.
about the innate knowledge of God. Interestingly enough, what changed that was my reflecting on Romans 1. So I was going through a time where I was trying to, this is the thing I do with a lot with my students. I make them memorize Romans chapter 1. And so I was working on that for myself. And I was going over that section 120 over and over again. You know how it is when you memorize
yeah.
something, you're saying over and over again. And I kept saying, through the things that are made, through what's been made, through what's been made. I said, wait a second. And it made me reflect on it. I said, wait a second. This knowledge doesn't seem to be, it's not like the inexcusability, the knowledge that makes them inexcusable isn't innate. It's coming through something. It's mediated through
yeah.
the creation. So it can't be that it's innate.
Yeah.
It's saying the exact opposite. It's not innate. It's not immediate. It's mediated. And so that was interesting transformation for me. But your question was,
yeah. Well, I think that's a good point to talk on, because a lot of people do take it that way, especially when they then say, although they knew God, starting off that sentence, they say, see, everybody knew God.
Right.
So that's a good point to address in Romans 1 is that knowledge innate? And maybe part of what you're getting at is this, that there's a problem just with the whole idea of, quote, innate knowledge, which is that when we know something, it is through proof of some kind. So we do use the word knowledge ambiguously, so we can recognize that. But when we're making a knowledge claim to other people, they're going to ask us, how do you know?
Right. Yeah, and this is, and this also, too, is the gravity of the circumstance.
Yeah.
We're talking about inexcusability of man before God.
Yeah.
And the implications of that are separation from God, divine punishment, eternal separation from God. So it's not like some minor thing. So this should be not like, we can't here afford to use this word ambiguously, like, well, I kind of know that God exists, or I kind of don't know. Say, no, the stakes are super high.
Yeah.
The highest, right?
I wonder if there's a kind of inverse relationship in the sense that as what is clear about God goes up, or I guess it's a direct relationship, not inverse, what's clear about God goes up, responsibility goes up. And the opposite is true as well. So that you'll find, you can do this kind of as a sociological experiment and look at Christian denominations who have downplayed or even denied how much we can know about God, that they'll also then raise questions about the punishment of not knowing God, and say, and they'll tend to lean towards universalism, because they'll tend to say everyone's doing their best.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the major questions in Christian apologetics is, particularly with Christian exclusivism, why only Christ?
Yeah.
The question, I think a lot of Christian apologists struggle with that question, because they don't have a good solid doctrine of the clarity of God's existence in place. Because if you don't have that, then that's a fair question, right? Why don't we need to believe in Christ? It just seems arbitrary and kind of random, and seems like they have that the person who never hears about Christ has an excuse if they don't get the gospel message. But with the clarity of God's existence that make all men inexcusable, then that question is really just kind of becomes dissolved, basically.
Yeah.
Because if a person doesn't hear about Christ, that has nothing to do with their responsibility to respond to what they have been shown.
Yeah, right. Know God.
Yeah.
And then it's not just a bare knowledge of God, like there's a first cause, but that the eternal power and divine nature. So for me, that was a game changer in two ways. One, the knowledge of God is available and it's our highest good, the clarity of God's existence, but then connected to that, the inexcusability of unbelief. So not only is knowing God our highest good, there's no excuse for not knowing God. And both of those come out there. And so for me, that connected up pieces I've been wondering about in terms of how do we know God and what is our responsibility before God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so there's interesting, because there's both a personal and a apologetic or evangelistic application of this. Personally, if we ourselves are to be repenting of our sin and it's clear that God exists and we didn't see that, is that a sin that we should be repenting of? And why did we not see it? Is it because we didn't seek it all? We didn't care to see? If it's clear, is an implication I like to give a lot to my students. If something's clear and you don't see it, what can we infer about you?
Right.
And they resist it a little bit, and then ultimately they have to say, we're not seeking, we're not going after it. I say, exactly. So if God's existence is clear and we've not seen it, the inference we have to make is we haven't cared to see
it. Well, and especially because I think they might say, I see it. But that if you know it, you could show it.
Right.
That's where the resistance comes in. Because then they'll say, no, I knew God exists. Everybody does.
Right.
And you can go out on the street and start to ask people, do you know God exists? And some of them will say no. And some of them will say, I know he doesn't exist. So when you start to press on that point.
Yeah, that's good. Because that gets into the second application, which is sort of the apologetic or evangelistic application, is we're calling people to radically change their life.
Yeah.
We're saying basically, okay, everything that you've been, this trajectory you've been going down, completely change it and go this way, right? Completely change your entire worldview. And I think if someone did that to you, you'd say, okay, why?
Yeah.
Like that's not a resistant, you don't have to be an obstinate person to ask that question. That's a normal human rational thing to say. Okay, you want me to do that? Okay, why? Why should I do that?
Mm-hmm.
And so if the people aren't prepared to give the answer to how do you know, in other words, how do you know the things you're saying are true?
Yeah.
Which I think is what you're bringing up. Then it really empties that call to repentance of any meaning.
Yeah.
Because it's just like you might just arbitrarily tell them.
Yeah, it becomes more like joining a team or picking a hobby.
Yeah.
I kind of like this one. I should mention that I did my dissertation on this topic in philosophy, and it's out as the book, The Clarity of God's Existence. And in there, I look at some of these questions, especially about what is the relationship between how clear it is and our inexcusability and our need for Christ, and challenges that have come up to belief in God in modern philosophy. But I want to thank you, Greg, for the discussion.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This was a good one about apologetics, and I'm looking forward to more in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.